Well, we're at a Farm Bill meeting here near Meade, Nebraska today at the UNL Extension Research Center. And we're going to talk with Brad Lubin, who is a UNL Extension Ag Policy Specialist. And Brad, you've done a couple of these meetings in Kansas. You got a couple here in Nebraska this week. Let's talk about, just in general, the Farm Bill. And, you know, we had so much activity last year, and everybody's saying, well, we're going to get this Farm Bill done, you know, maybe by the first of the year. And now we have people talking about we may have to extend it a year.
Right. Yeah, we certainly have questions about the outlook for not just what will be in the Farm Bill, but the timing of the bill, whether it actually comes and gets completed in time for the September 2018 deadline when it's due, or whether we debate getting it done versus maybe extending current legislation. Part of that challenge, I would say, is the issues that always drive every Farm Bill debate: the economics, the budget challenge, the trade arena, where we're maybe more uncertain than ever right now, and of course the political environment that we're operating in. One of the real challenges on the economic side of this is writing a Farm Bill for a low price commodity cycle. We haven't done that since 2002. The last two Farm Bills were written really for a trending positive commodity cycle, not the down cycle. So trying to find the policies that fit for this environment is more difficult to start. That causes some challenges. Trying to find the budget that would pay for a safety net written for low prices can be a challenge. And there's one of the timing issues, to get back to the question, which was we had to solve outstanding issues, particularly with cotton and dairy, because of demands for requests from those production sectors for substantial changes in policy, which were going to cost dollars if enacted as part of a new Farm Bill. Well, you couldn't really get the Farm Bill process started until you resolve those issues one way or the other. The Budget Act passed in February does in fact include provisions to cover cotton and dairy, which maybe takes care of that issue and resolves the budget question, such that the rest of the Farm Bill could really get started here in earnest.
As far as timing, nobody knows, but I know R. Barnaby told me he thinks if it doesn't get done in the next 30 days, that then you get into re-election campaigns and that type of thing. It could call for an extension.
Right. Saying that we crossed a major hurdle with cotton and dairy and we can now get the Farm Bill started in earnest, we still need an official budget number from the CBO to know where to move this thing. But it certainly sounds like a lot of the discussion is already done, or at least the framework's already put in place. It just has to be introduced formally and go through committee and for consideration. That being said, it has to get done in a timely fashion. Otherwise, we already start running out of legislative days, and we start running out of time before campaigns for midterm elections really take over. Do we finish a Farm Bill on time so that we can go home and campaign about having accomplished it? Or do we end up pushing off a Farm Bill because we campaign about what we want more so than what we've accomplished? You can draw a scenario either way that really puts pressure on getting it done soon or seeing it continue to lag and end up in an extension.
So the big question, I guess, would be crop insurance, and, you know, are we going to see some cuts there? And again, we kind of reviewed those with Art Barnaby, but his big concern is means testing and whether some larger farmers actually exit the program.
Right. On the crop insurance side, if you took notes of every Farm Bill hearing, I think that's happened in the last year and a half or more, every one of them typically says crop insurance is the number one priority, as in it works. It provides an important safety net that's the foundation of producers' risk management decisions. Producers pay in to the program, and so they invest in that safety net as well. And producers generally said, just please hold the program harmless and do no harm. And yet all the proposals floating from various interest groups and even from the administration are about places to cut. Well, if crop insurance ends up taking cuts, will they affect the program performance? That doesn't just hurt the people that effectively leave the program or get kicked out of the program because of means testing or subsidy limits, et cetera. That possibly hurts the people that stay in the program because of the performance of the remaining portfolio of producers as opposed to the broader portfolio. There are lots of questions about how well crop insurance performs going forward if you put pressure on it in terms of any cuts to the program.
As far as the Title I programs, the commodity programs, I know we've talked before about, you know, the potential for a shift over to the PLC program as ARC looks less attractive this time around. Is that still something you see happening?
If we looked at today's numbers and projections, for example, from USDA that just released 10-year baseline projections here back in February, if those numbers truly foretell a market where we're roughly at current price levels with stability but only modest recovery, then that kind of price environment certainly favors producers enrolling more in the price support or the price safety net, the PLC program, as opposed to the ARC program. The ARC program started out with a strong safety net under the 14 Farm Bill, but it was based on strong average prices. As prices have now fallen for multiple years, that average has fallen, and the safety net going forward doesn't look as high as what the PLC safety net is at present levels. Now, that's if we are at sort of current levels projected with only modest recovery up. If we have any shocks, one way or the other, we could shock our way through supply problems or maybe demand growth that gets us back to levels where neither program pays substantially. And we generally would favor that kind of environment, hope for it. We could also imagine shocks that hurt the current price outlook even further, whether it's continued years of above average production or whether it's demand shocks, including concerns about trade issues and trade prospects. That could put even more pressure on both the safety nets in terms of expenditures going forward.
Are there other parts of the Farm Bill discussion that you think are important that people should be watching?
You know, one of the areas certainly that producers are keenly aware of, and landowners as well on the conservation side, we have questions about both the CRP and the working lands programs. With the CRP, we have basically maxed out enrollment under our new lower 24 million acre cap. It's hard to grow that program, even as some producers are interested in putting some land back in given relatively low commodity prices. You can't grow it unless we find funding to raise the cap. One of the options that's also been floated out there is to reduce the payment rates on contracts going forward, perhaps to reduce them to 80% of the county average rental rates instead of the current 100. That would save some money. That might be a way that we actually pay for more acres as well. So we'll see what happens to the CRP. On the working lands programs, the EQIP program and the CSP program, both have continued to grow over time, and yet the question always remains about where will be the budget support and what will be the continued opportunities for future participation in those programs. Conservation is a critical area. It rivals the commodity programs in terms of total spending, and it clearly is a popular area of support and attention.
One of the big stories this past week, along with some of the trade issues that have come up, is the RFS program, and a lot of discussions going on about capping RIN prices, waiver for E15 on the RVP. I mean, this is important stuff to this part of the country.
Right. These are critical pieces of the demand side of the equation. Looking at the role of trade and exports as a percentage of production, looking at the current renewable fuels market and the amount of production that goes towards the renewables, we're talking about more than half of the demand between those two sectors. And any sort of policy shocks really do have a tremendous impact on producers' bottom lines and on the prospects ahead for the sector as a whole. We've talked about the uncertainty with trade and the concerns about a trade war or at least a escalation of tensions that might harm U.S. ag export prospects. We could talk about the renewables market and this fight between the proponents of renewable fuels that say the mandate is there to mandate usage and we have to grow towards that usage, and the opponents of the current mandate that says yes, but it's economically costly, and compliance is a burden to you know, to the refiners and the blenders. If you look at the current debate, and one of the proposals has been from the opponents has been to cap the RINs price, the renewable identification numbers. If the concern is that the RINs price is too high, well, the price is there as a signal to blend. If the market infrastructure doesn't exist to allow that blending to occur, then you have concerns about the infrastructure. One alternative is to basically do away with the mandate, as has been proposed by some. Another alternative is to fund and invest in the infrastructure, which means more blender pumps that can do E15 up to E85, or it means potentially relaxing the limitation on E15 during the summer as a way to expand potential growth and utilization. But the argument that says we can't get to a higher mandate, or we can't get to higher usage, therefore the mandate to find a way to higher usage is too economically painful, therefore we should eliminate the mandate, kind of ignores the whole purpose of the mandate in the beginning. Whether that solves the debate, I don't know. But we'll continue to face real concerns over shocks to demand here, as long as we're debating renewables, and as long as we're continuing to debate exports as well.
This cap on RINs prices, I know it's confusing to a lot of people just how that works, but I don't know if you've had a chance to study it. I mean, is that, as some people say, is that would kill the program?
What I've seen described as proposals to put a cap on a RINs price. Why does a RIN have a price in the first place? Because some blenders would find it easier to buy the credit from somebody else as opposed to do the blending themselves. And you can imagine in certain small refineries or in certain markets, the opportunity to market blends may be more challenging and more costly. Therefore, buying a credit from another market where there's plenty of blending going on makes sense. That's why there's a market for that, as opposed to a mandate that every single refiner, every single blender and wholesaler has to comply. So that's why there's a market for moving around credits. The idea to put a maximum price on RINs at levels of, as have been proposed, essentially says there's a minimal cost of avoiding compliance by just buying a credit. There's not much incentive left for actually complying. It could eliminate a lot of participation and a lot of renewable usage, at least in markets where it's an economic cost to try and blend in renewables. So yes, as some are proposing, putting a relatively modest cap on RINs is one way to effectively eliminate the role of the mandate in the first place.
And then the idea of the waiver for E15, you know, the other side argues that would take care of the RIN price, or would drive the RIN price down.
Right. At the moment, one would argue if we're debating why do RINs have a price, because it's easier to buy a credit than it is to blend, because in some markets it's difficult to get above E10. The blend wall, so to speak. If the ceiling was put at E15 instead of E10, then in many markets you could utilize more biofuels, more ethanol, under that E15 wall instead of an E10 wall, and that would be sufficient to use our capacity and meet the renewable mandate in terms of total usage, such that the price of compliance would virtually disappear. As such, then there wouldn't be pressure on a RINs market, because there wouldn't be much of a price penalty to pay for compliance. Now that's the ethanol side of that. There's still a biodiesel side and an advanced renewable side that aren't completely solved in that same way. But on the ethanol side, either have the capacity to utilize blends and utilize production up to the mandate that way, or pay a RINs price that forces people to look at ways to expand capacity.